we were about to make the jump over the Mississippi River in the westward expansion. So let's begin with the recognition of the land. We meet today in the traditional territories of the Tsleil-Waututh, Tsleil-Waututh, Chinpashawshuk, Squaxchuk, and Mamachapan peoples who were stewards of these lands and waters since time immemorial. I condemn the violence and dislocation that led to the loss of land and culture among these people. I grieve the damage to families and communities through multiple generations that this has caused them, and resolve to seek restoration and healing with them. I think you've seen this before. This explains who all those people were. And before we begin, I follow John Noltner and his work, who he goes around the country taking pictures of people and asks them what's on their mind. And he gets some real gems, and I thought this is perfect for this situation. People are unwilling to acknowledge past and current injustices, period. You know, that's the let's move on attitude. Without recognizing their ownership and privilege, they won't be able to utilize their power to work towards change. And I think that applies in what we're talking about here, certainly. Well, we're basically picking up at the point where the effective resistance of First Nations people east of the Mississippi had been broken by the dissolution of the Shawnee Confederacy that was fighting the new American government. The country had already looked west of the Mississippi in the Lewis and Clark expedition, which in 1804, 1806, but incidentally, it came through the lower Columbia and cataloged the First Nations down that way, as far up as the Yakima, but it didn't get quite up this far. It was 1811 when the British explorer John Thompson came down from British Columbia and came through the upper Columbia that there was first contact, basically, with the local First Nations. This young U.S. government was using a combination of wars, treaties, and reservations to basically move the First Nations around to where they wanted them. Increasingly, it was just further west. War seemed to come first with them, then a treaty, and then there might be a reservation. And that was basically the rule for about 200 years. You remember, we had gotten into the Indiana Territory, and Governor William Henry Harrison wanted to clear Indiana quickly of First Nations people and bring it to statehood as a slave state. In the Battle of Tippecanoe that followed a meeting that he had with Tecumseh, that Tecumseh had asked for to divine what the intentions of the governor was. That battle ended the organized resistance and ushered in the War of 1812. In this speech to Governor Harrison in the summer of 1811, this is what he said about selling land. Some versions online that you see of this say that add a sentence that doesn't appear to be authentic, but it was, all you've given our children is more rum and the grave, which it just doesn't trim up enough to be authentic seeming. But it would have been apt. I think someone had that idea, so they thought they would put it in there. So this is Indiana. We'll just go through where we left off. The Battle of Tippecanoe happened near Prophetstown. That was named for Tecumseh's brother, who was this visionary prophet who had these religious rules. A, we don't sell our land, and B, we have to go back to our traditional spirituality and resist conversion to Christianity. The next thing is my hometown, which is Crawfordsville, and it's interesting because Indiana achieved statehood in 1816. Fortunately, not as a slave state. Harrison didn't get his wish. So in 1820, the Interior Department went out and found a place to put a land office, because that's one of the first things you do when you have a new state. You have a land office and then they send out surveyors. So that's where they put the land office in a little log cabin. And a year later, my great-great-grandfather showed up and bought land. In 1822 or 3, we're not sure, he went back to Ohio. He was living down near Cincinnati, where Cincinnati is now. It wasn't Cincinnati then. And brought his bride up there and started his farm with 160 acres. In 1879, when he passed away, his farm was 2,000 acres. He had apprenticed as a tanner, so on this farm he started with a tanning yard and he started growing things and keeping animals, and it became very lucrative. It was very fertile ground. Also around here, I said at the last time I mentioned that the Lenape, or the Delawares, had finally left Ohio and come into Indiana. And there was a subgroup of the Lenape called the Munsee, with two S-E-E at the end, that were located in the lower Hudson Valley in New York. And they found themselves a place and they founded this settlement here. It turned into the city of the modern city of Muncie, Indiana. And right close by was the town of Anderson, which was named after a Lenape chief who founded it. His name was John Anderson. His father was Swedish and his mother was Lenape. And they came from Delaware Bay region, where New Sweden was located. Lenape is probably the only North American language into which the Small Catechism has been translated, Luther's Small Catechism, and it was done very early. In any case, those two towns are right next to each other. The other place of interest is further up the Sugar Creek, which runs through Crawfordsville, about 15 miles. The Eel River Miami town of Kawiakungi was where, if you remember Little Turtle, his little band of people who kept claiming they were not Miamis, they wanted their own place. Well, the government finally believed them and gave them this little reservation on this little spot here. So they moved down from the Eel River, which the Eel River is right up here, and that whole area had been cleared of First Nations people. So, and that's the way things looked. There was one more little settlement there that was about 10 miles south of town. If you remember Chief Cornstalk, a Shawnee chief whose murder hardened the Shawnees against the American government and made them go on their resistance movement. Either his grandson or a great-nephew named Peter Cornstalk had his winter hunting camp there, and he had his summer fields over there by Muncie or Anderson. So So they would go back and forth the 60 or 70 miles by the seasons. And this has driven our local historians crazy, trying to figure out how a Shawnee chief ended up in a Lenape settlement. It was simple. He just married a Lenape woman, and these people are matrilineal, had to move in with the in-laws. So all of these things that happen much further east end up being sprinkled around my hometown, which I found a curious coincidence. And this is the answer to the question I asked my mother when I was 9, what Indians lived around here? As the situation unfolded after the Battle of Tippecanoe, there was a lot of poverty among these First Nations. They weren't getting annuities from the government. The fur trade was in the bucket, and they were already starting to see the arrival of settlers because of that land office. The other thing that happened around in this time was 1818. After the War of 1812, the British and U.S. governments had got together and said, well, we've got to sort out this thing from, you know, the Great Lakes to the Pacific and what our mutual border is. And that's when they picked the 49th parallel. And that line drawn from Lake of the Woods in Minnesota to the Pacific Ocean cut through a lot of big First Nations like the Blackfoot in Montana and some of the Sioux Nations and the Lakes, Salish Nation north of here. And they started calling it the Medicine Line because they thought this line had great medicine. If the U.S. cavalry was chasing them, it would suddenly make them stop. So I tell people down here I'm from north of the Medicine Line. So that's where we ended up. And then things started happening in U.S. politics. And in 1829, Andrew Jackson got elected president. He got inaugurated in 1829, and his very first State of the Union message, he promised that he would clear all of the First Nations people out of the region east of the Mississippi. That was his platform, and he went about doing it. You know, he was a Southerner. He had fought, he was, quote, an Indian fighter. He had fought the Southern First Nations, the Seminoles, the Choctaws, the Creeks, all of the ones down in the Carolinas and Georgia. And he was a populist. He wanted to throw out the sort of federalist series of presidents that had happened since Washington and ended up with John Quincy Adams. So that was his program. And the result was this. This is a map, a current day map of American Indian reservations. The purple splotches are federal reservations. Is there anything you notice about it? It's very heavy over to the left, isn't it? Jackson pretty much did what he said he was going to do. And of course, the methods they used were for the Cherokees, for example, they just went and told them, get up, move to what is now Oklahoma, and march with all your women, children, and old people, and you know, hundreds of them died along the way. It was a horrible thing. They did the same thing to the Potawatomis in southern Michigan, northern Indiana. The Potawatomi call their march the Trail of Death. That little splotch of purple in Oklahoma has all kinds of reservations crammed in there, including the Lenape Reservation. The only reservation the Lenape have is in there. So at this point, by the mid-1830s into the mid-1840s, the country was definitely looking westward, and the government was starting to gear up its apparatus to take care of that. I forget exactly the date, but a Bureau of Indian Affairs was established. Would you like to guess which department of the government it was put in?
Department of War.
It was in the War Department. The easier to coordinate with the cavalry. Besides, they were used to that, well, when we're dealing with Indians, we're going to have war at some point. But after this, there was a change in policy. Reservations became the preferred tool for dealing with First Nations. The method was sort of, well, let's hold a treaty council first and see if we can get a reservation. Then if that doesn't work, we'll have a war. Or we'll get a reservation and then see if they like it. And if they don't, then we'll probably have a war anyway. So it was the third choice. And the ultimate effect of this, it was ethnic cleansing. Then on to 1850. And this was a very important thing for this region. And I want to start talking about this region. I'm going to skip over a lot of things that are important, but it gets repetitious. Of course, I'm not talking about the Battle of Greasy Grass, which is Little Bighorn. I'm not talking about many of the wars that happened both in the Southwest and in the Plains. I do want to get to what happened here in Washington. So in 1850, this Donation Land Claim Act promised the grant of 320 acres to any settler, and this in the Oregon Territory. The Oregon Territory was what is now Oregon and Washington. 320 acres for any settler willing to work the land. After 1855, the price would rise to $1.25 an acre. So you'd have to have a grub stake to get the land then. So there was a 5-year open window for settlement. And this ramped up the settlement pressure in this region, which already was coming on top of the initial talk about railroad. So that was one of the big economic drivers that was already being talked about at the time. 5 years later, the governor of Washington Territory, and is now a territory, Isaac Stevens, decided he was going to deal with the Indian problem. I would say that Governor Stevens was not a man of finesse. He was very open that he was a promoter of development. He avidly wanted the railroad to come through Washington Territory. And in fact, the original surveying of Railroad Creek was to see if it was a suitable place to put the railroad. They got to Bonanza Peak up here and said, we're not going to drill through this thing. And they decided it wasn't, but it still was called Railroad Creek. And he wanted to attract settlers. So he called the Council of Walla Walla, which went on from the end of May for about 2 weeks into June. And he trooped all the First Nations he could attract through this and sit down with him and talk about, how about a reservation? So what he did was he got hold of the principal chief of the Yakima, and the Yakima are one of the biggest nations around here. By comparison, the Wenatchees were a very tiny group and had already heavily intermarried with the Yakimas and had a lot of relations in the Yakima tribe. And so he told the Yakima chief, Kamayakan, gather all the chiefs in the region and we'll talk, who are along the Columbia, and we'll talk about reservations. So one chief from the Wenatchee Nation named Chukulikun came, and a chief from the Antiats and from the next valley, Lahum. The Squashkunuk, the Moses Columbia group crossed the river, who were a fairly good-sized outfit, declined to come, and particularly the Chelans declined to come. The Chelan chief Inmozitsa, or in the English, he's usually spelled Inmozitsa, he was a grumpy old guy. He wasn't actually that old, but he had no interest in dealing with the U.S. government. He basically told them to go jump in the lake. And in after this there was an attempt by Stevens to try and get them to, you know, get with the program. And Inmozitsa and Moses, the chief of the Sinkiyus across the river, got together and said, we'd better figure out what we're going to do because they're going to come after us. And so a small detachment of cavalry was sent to Moses Coulee, where Moses and his people were, and they were ready for them. And it was like one of those things, is described as like one of those things in cowboy movies where the cavalry rides in and suddenly the hillsides are topped with braves on horseback. And Moses and Inmozitsa ride out and say to the captain of this little detachment, Inmozitsa speaks, he says, I'm going to be the interpreter. Chief Moses says, you go back across the river and mind your own business, which they promptly did. But that didn't stop Governor Stevens. He started talking about the Moses problem. Moses is one of the sort of venerated and older chiefs that everybody would listen to and follow. So this didn't really work for Governor Stevens. So about the same time, this is sometime after this particular confrontation happened, sometime after the Treaty Council, and they were starting to propose new reservations. They first proposed a reservation to Moses that was just too far east. He said, no, we want to be closer to the Columbia. It was east of the Okanagan River, which is north of here, and then east. So I'll get into the details of that, but I'd like to go back to this treaty and show you some of the provisions. Something that affects the Wenatchees was Article 10. Article 10 stated that they get to keep their fishery and they get a reservation there. This fishery is located in Leavenworth on Highway 2. Did anybody here come through Leavenworth? My kids always wanted to stop for ice cream there. But right as you coming from the west, as you come into town, right to the right side of the road, there's the confluence of Icicle Creek. That confluence was one of the richest salmon fishing grounds in the territory, and it belonged to the Wenatchee. So Article 10 gives them this, this fishery. There was one other article that is worth noting, and that's Article 6, which says that the president may, if he so chooses, chop up your reservation and turn it into little allotments and give it to you. So that he could, if he wanted, cut it up into farms and give some Indians the farm and then give settlers the farms. Because these were big reservations, they were millions of acres. I think the original offer was about 7 million, but Moses didn't like that one. Then he got one that was 11 million. We'll go into those details. The problem was that the overall treaty said basically every nation that signs this are now to be considered forever to be the part of the Yakama Nation, and Kamayakan is their chief. This is probably the carrot he dangled in front of Kamayakan to go to the trouble of gathering all these people together. It's pretty clear that people didn't understand that's what they were doing because of their behavior afterwards. The Wenatchee and Intiat people who had signed it said, "What?" And the government came around to them and said, "All right, it's time you move to your reservation," because part of the provisions also gave the Yakimas their big reservation, which they still have today, although it's been cut down too. In any case, the Intiats didn't go anew to Moses. They stayed where they were. The Chelans were not even represented, as were the Moses weren't either, the Moses Columbias. And they would not consider joining the Yakima Reservation. And that's what they told the government. And this upset Governor Stevens. So they created, in 1872, they created a new reservation called the Colville Reserve. And it was a pretty sizable thing. Moses still didn't like that. The Colville was actually created for a lot of other tribes further to the north and the east, but they thought, well, let's throw the Chelans and the Moses Columbia in there too. But Moses didn't want to go there either, and neither did Inomasecha, because he wouldn't even talk to the governor. So this is a map showing the various options for the reservation. This green here is the first thing they offered Chief Moses. In the interim, the Intiats, the Chelans, and Chief Moses had gotten together and said, let's all get together and be a coalition, and they'll have to give us some piece of ground. Well, then they offered them this orange thing. This border right here is the opposite side of Lake Chelan. So it would include a lot of shorefront on it, Lake Chelan, which the Chelans liked. And I think it included the town of Chelan, which was the Chelan settlement. And Moses liked it. And he told the general who brought the news and said, well, this will make me a very big Indian. But almost immediately, as soon as the offer was made and news got out among settlers, there was a whole bunch of them, and particularly miners along the Canadian border, who said, wait a minute, you can't do that. We're staking out claims here. And there was a great kerfuffle. A lot of people went down to find the governor and give him an earful. And so they backed off of that. So they made the Colville Reserve very big here in the middle and said, well, this is where you have to go. Inomasecha held out for quite a while, and they wore Chief Moses down, and he eventually agreed to go there by about 1880. Inomasecha never did. The Chelans didn't actually officially go there, although some families did. What happened was eventually the government came in and divided the shore of Lake Chelan down where the settlement was into allotments and gave each family a mile square. And that's the way it ended up. And so where there is now First Nations land down there, that was done by the allotment system. So nobody was terribly happy about that. further south, in fact, before the ink was barely dry on the treaty, the Yakimas and their allies were very upset, and they started what's called the Yakima War. Part of the problem was they weren't setting up the reservation right away, and the papers had to go to Washington, and Stevens went to Washington to present it to the Senate. It had to be approved and all that stuff, and they were very impatient, and so a war broke out with the Yakima. It went on for a while, and there was a battle down around Toppenish that sort of finished that. But not about 20 years after they made the Colville Reservation, they decided they needed even more room for settlers, and they cut it in half. And the area that outlined is blue, in blue is what the current reservation is. The northern half was divided up into plots, and allotments were given to First Nations who were living up there, and the balance were given to settlers. So that was an unhappy almost 40 years. But that didn't end the unhappiness. For one thing, in 1887, the Dawes Act opened up almost all federal land for homesteading. And you got advertising like this. And those names at the bottom aren't real estate agents. You know, that's the Bureau, that's the Commissioner of Indian Affairs and the Secretary of the Interior advertising this stuff. And this exponentially increased the flow of settlers in here. It's interesting, the motivation for the Dawes Act was sponsored by a senator named Dawes, and one thing he said that it's time we persuaded the First Nations people to assume a capitalist and proprietary relationship with property. So it effectively ended the kind of land tenure that First Nations were used to in the country, where there was a commons and they all used it. They had certain rights to certain resources like their fisheries. Everything was going to be marked on the ground in little squares and divided up. The federal government remained the only buyer that could buy First Nations land, so they couldn't sell it on the free market. Throughout this whole period, there was a reason why Indian land was so cheap. There was only one buyer for it. And in 1823, the Supreme Court had affirmed this because there was a dispute over someone who thought they bought some Indian land, and the government went out and sold it again to somebody else. And it ended up in the Supreme Court. And what the Supreme Court did was they concluded, and John Marshall, the Chief Justice, wrote the opinion, concluded that the successful revolution against the English king and the founding of a new government meant that the new government inherited all of the rights that belonged to the British crown, which meant the whole doctrine of discovery story then became an American one. Because one of the principles of the doctrine of discovery was that the government owns everything that it doesn't sell to individual people, and that the original inhabitants have limited options, that is, they can only sell to the government. When they did this, this raised another important question that caused a lot of problem, and that's, what then qualifies someone to be an Indian and get one of these allotments out of the land be allotted to them. And this is still an issue in First Nations, as to who do we allow to come onto our reservation? And it still has not been satisfactorily figured out. This takes us up to 1890, which for most historians is kind of the end of the expansion period. And that's the massacre at Wounded Knee. I don't know if you've ever read Edward S.B. Brown's book, Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, but this is a photograph taken in a town near the site of someone bringing in a wounded child that they found in the battlefield the next morning. This was near the end of 1890 when a force from the U.S. 7th Cavalry, and I will remind you that that is the force that was commanded by Colonel Custer and was wiped out. They had long memories. There was a group of Lakota who were being led into the area where the reserve was to give themselves up. They had been part of the Sundance movement, which was a new spirituality in the West, and the government, particularly after the Prophet in Indiana, was very suspicious of these native spirituality movements. And they wanted to round these people up and put them on the reservation where they could watch them. But this was not a war party by any means. And they were close by to where they were supposed to end up, and the cavalry went out to meet them and wanted to go through the encampment and disarm everybody. Well, one young brave didn't want to give up his rifle. He complained that he paid a lot of money for it and he wanted to keep it. And so this struggle broke out over the rifle and it went off. And what happened was the cavalry members started shooting. And there were 250 casualties. More than 50 wounded. And that essentially finishes the era of westward expansion and its effect on First Nations. The government now, switches to a new policy, a policy of assimilation. And the instrument for assimilation that immediately came to mind for people was, well, let's build schools there. We'll contract out the running of them so they won't be a problem. And these schools will, in fact, cause the students there to grow up as assimilated Americans. This was the idea of a Captain Richard Pratt, who did an experiment with 72 children from somewhere in the plains, where he set up a school and he set them up as if they were regular American children in store-made clothes, and they cut their hair and all that, and they took them through lessons and everything. And at a conference in 1892, he said this. The great general he's referring to is General Philip Sheridan, who was a Civil War general. But he coined the phrase, kill the Indian in him and save the man. And that was kind of the slogan of these schools. And that statement is the basis for the claims by First Nations people that the intent of these schools was a cultural genocide. So from about 1879 on, schools of this sort were policy in the U.S. government to put them near reservations and to ship the kids to them. They call them boarding schools. We have them in Canada. They're called residential schools there. they were often run by many of the same orders in the Catholic Church. The school that is behind this was the St. Mary's Mission, or they call the Colville Mission School at Omak. Omak is a town that is in the territory of the Colville Reservation. I have found some testimony from people who were teachers at this school. This school was still, you know, it started in the early 1900s. It was still running in the 60s. So this young woman Jodine Grundy was a young teacher, and she took a job teaching at this school as one of the lay teachers. The rest of them were priests and nuns. And she began, after a few months, to really feel like this is the wrong thing to do. The systematically removing kids from their culture and their families and Christianizing them. Because, of course, part and parcel of this was conversion. Eventually, she had a dream that caused her to leave. Then, in this dream, she saw that this place was the place of the devil. Then, this is a contemporary interview, and in 2018, she got a letter from the office that ministers the Jesuit orders who supply the priests for this place, informing her that they had discovered a possible abuse by one of the priests with whom she served. She remembered him well. He was very, he was almost peripatetic. He was always around the school, going around. He knew all the teachers and all the kids. And he was a very high-profile member of the community. She had not herself witnessed anything, but she remembered that she learned after she left that he had been transferred very shortly after she left. And she wonders if there was any connection between her departure and his removal, that they were worried that she had seen something and might report it. Whatever the case, that's just kind of a suspicion that people had. We have since learned much more about these places that is even more disturbing. This is the Kamloops Indian Residential School that you may have heard about in the news last year, where they found 215 unmarked graves. I have a personal connection to this building. I have worked in it a long time ago, in the 80s and early 90s. I went to meetings there, and then eventually the program that my university ran that I was part of got some portables nearby that were our offices and classrooms. So I know a number of people who were survivors of this school, who were members of the Secwepemc Nation who ran this school. It was also a Catholic school. The Secwepemc Nation, of which Kamloops was the principal settlement, was enormous. It was about 56,000 square miles. There are 17 bands in the nation, and one of the people I worked with for 30 years was the elected chief of the Skeetriston Band, which is outside of Kamloops, for most of that time. And he was a residential school survivor. And I knew them all of this time, But they were very reticent to talk about it. They acknowledged that they were survivors of the school, but they never talked about their experiences. And I want to... I'm glad I didn't try and pry, because that would have been the wrong thing to do. I've learned about how this kind of thing gets... Henry Nouwen described once a kind of a repression that feels like a great ball of frozen ice in the middle of you. And I think that's pretty much the way it was for them. A colleague and friend of mine, Chief Ron Ignace, who I've worked with for 30 years, went to the school through the eighth grade, as did his aunt. This is his aunt, Mona Jules, who was one of our first language instructors in the language program that we started at the school. She was a very good teacher, and this was one of the things that I had to persuade the university they ought to do, is to hire people who were speakers of the language, who were not necessarily qualified to teach university courses. But she did a really good job for a long time. She passed away about a month ago. This is Ron. Kukpi in Tsleil Waututh, the language, means chief. He was a student here until the eighth grade when he ran away. When I talk about these things, I'm not going to reveal anything that I know personally. Everything that I say comes from things that Ron has made public in interviews and in newspaper articles and so forth, and in a book that he's written. He tells about how he got away from the school in his book, and in one of the interviews. His aunt, Mona Jules, had preceded him in the school, and she had a younger sister who was still older than he was, who had disappeared at the school. His grandfather had come to the school and beaten up one of the priests. Curiously, the school didn't do anything about it. They just made him go away. They didn't report it to the authorities. Almost certainly, his aunt is one of the 250. I think, you know, when I feel like this, how must it feel to them? In one of the interviews, he says, he knows that the priest came and told boys, "We have some apple trees we need to plant in the morning. Go dig some holes in the orchard." And they would take them out and they would dig holes. The students would wonder the next day why there were no apple trees planted in the holes. The holes were just gone. He says, "I'm telling you this secondhand. I don't really know. I don't have first-hand knowledge. I didn't ever do the digging. But this is what I heard." But when he heard about the discovery of the graves, he said, "I bet it's in the old orchard." And it was. But this kind of atmosphere of terror is how they disempowered everyone. he talks frequently about the strategy of disempowerment that goes on in these schools. And he said this, he said, one of the things they do as soon as you walk into the school, they sit you down and cut your hair. The only time you cut your hair is when there's a death in the family, to mourn. To us, our strength, our power, our dignity, and our humanity was represented by our hair. That was taken from us right away. Other things he said in interviews after this, and this is the other thing, that in the time after the revelation of all these graves, he and his aunt and a number of other survivors came forward and started, they decided, we need to go public with this. It tore our humanity apart. It taught us to be cruel to each other. And I think that in that there's a kernel of this problem of intergenerational trauma, that this atmosphere of terror, you learn cruelty that you wouldn't have learned at home. He says this, regardless of how those 215 children died, why, you have to ask, were they buried in unmarked graves? There are people out there who say they probably died of measles, smallpox, you know. But if they did, why did they not notify the parents so they could be taken home and have a proper burial? Canada has to look deep into its soul to understand what systemic racism is and to uproot it. When he was a teenager and in the eighth grade, one of his uncles came to the school, and he told the interviewer, and it's a television interviewer, he said, I realized he was here to get me. And the uncle came and found him, and they went out the back, and he knew some ways to get off the campus, and they got out and went away, and they took him up north, you know, 56,000 square miles. There was a settlement of the nation up in the sort of halfway up the province. And he hid out at a relative's house for nearly a year. And every time white people were seen outside, he would crawl under a bed in a back room because the truant officers would come after you. And most people who ran away got taken back. So that is his story, and as I said, he was the chief for 30 years in his community, and he, along the way, he got a PhD in anthropology. He's written books on the history of his people, and he is now, since last year, he's the Federal Commissioner for Indigenous Languages. He's the very first Commissioner of Indigenous Languages in Canada. Canada has two official languages, and for years has had a Commissioner of Official Languages, who happens to always be French-speaking for some reason, to ensure that there is equity between the two official languages. And the First Nations of the country who were lobbying for work to save and improve their traditional languages, I've been asking the government for years to appoint a commissioner. A commissioner is an officer of parliament who advises the government on what to do about indigenous languages and reviews legislation and advises committees, testifies at committees, and so forth. So before we go on, I want to stop there and have a bit of a conversation. I turn on the speaker because we're going to do a video in a minute, which is the last thing. And I, before we have a conversation, I have been, for the past year, I've been trying to figure out, you know, how do you talk to people who are survivors? And it's very difficult. And I have concluded that for most of us who are settlers, the first thing you have to do is you have to sit there and listen. And I think of, you know, being like the friends of Job. You know, they sat on the ground for 7 days and seven nights and said nothing. Any comments, any thoughts? Don't feel bad. Most people are speechless in the face of this sort of thing.
Well, I'm from North Dakota.
Yes.
And I mean, there's extensive, you know, we have the reservations there. And, you know, Fort Totten is, you know, an old place now that had also had a school for children.
Yeah.
They've, at least the story is starting to be out now, so when you go visit that, they have the stories of the abuse and they have the pictures. So I think North Dakotans are just starting to learn about it.
Right. I can tell you that when this story came out in British Columbia, it really hit people. The Secretary of the Interior, Deb Haaland, has been going around holding meetings about this, and her department produced a report in May on the boarding school issues. And she's committed to a process. We had a process in Canada several years ago. I think it's at least 10 now. And they produced a report on truth and reconciliation. Since then, a lot of people have said reconciliation is the wrong word, because reconciliation means to restore a right relationship between two people, and there never was a right relationship to begin with. But there were something over 90 action items coming out of that. The government has been working away at doing some of them. Some of it is, you know, financial, setting up funds, and there's a lot still to come. And I'm sure you read about the Pope's visit, which turned out to be very controversial. There were some people who thought, well, this is a start. I'm talking about First Nations people, while others were saying, well, too little, too late. And the thing that really drove them wild was they gave him a headdress. And it was very controversial, and within the nation they awarded him this thing. Because a headdress is what, it's exactly like the Grand Chief of the Assembly First Nations wears, and it's all of these eagle feathers. And eagle feathers have the strongest medicine of you know, any of the sort of things that you might collect to have in your medicine bag. And here they were really upset about this. So that controversy is not done yet. There's all sorts of back and forth about it. I was surprised to see that. Any other thoughts or?
What are people, First Nations people, saying? I mean, it seems that to follow their lead is key.
Yes.
What are they saying? When are they?
Well,
are they ready to say?
They're moving ahead. The Tkamloops, Tshewakmak, are very well organized. They have a strong leader in the chief, Roseanne Casimir, and they're They've already set up an apparatus to investigate further. One of my colleagues who's worked on the reserve there, who is itself, he's Blackfoot, he's an indigenous archaeologist. He's done a lot of archaeology here on this reserve, and they've appointed him to oversee the study of the graves, and he said, look, this is going to take years. It is painstaking work, and it has to be done according to traditional protocols. So before I even put a tiny trowel in the ground, I will have to have instructions from elders on how this is to be carried out. And he said, this is going to take them years. But they said, we're going to do it. My thoughts on this are, throughout what I've been telling you, is that going back to the East Coast, and some of the chiefs there were saying, oh, all of these settlers, this isn't going to be good. And Tecumseh and his brother in the Midwest were saying, we have to resist this flood of settlers who are coming in and filling up our territories. And that just persisted all, and it happened even here in around here, where there were chiefs who said, no, we don't want all these settlers here. We want to have our own lands. And also for years after these schools were founded, as Ron Ignace said, there were people saying that this stuff had gone on, but they weren't listened to. And, you know, they were right all along. And that's the thing that settlers have to realize, that people were right all along and they didn't listen. Okay, any other comments or discussion?
What do you know about what's happening in the United States, like especially in our region?
I'm not aware of any current work, and I think what is happening now in the Interior Department is they're taking stock of what is going on and what it would take to do a survey. Ground-penetrating radar isn't that hard to use. It's kind of like running a lawnmower over an area. There was a fairly quick survey done in Canada after the discovery last year, and they came up with a lot more data, but they're still doing that. So I think they're going to let the facts be found. Meanwhile, the nations that are affected are taking steps to to deal with the mental health impacts of it. There's a lot of counseling and so forth going on.
In terms of some of the things that have been most obvious here, there's been the reality of disappeared or missing women and girls.
Yes.
Who were indigenous and efforts to make it so that attention gets paid to that circumstance.
In Canada, they call it the Murdered and Missing Indigenous Women and Children.
Yes.
And it's meant to include children who were in residential schools. And it is a problem. There's a problem in British Columbia. There's a highway on northern British Columbia they call the Highway of Tears. There is a large number of cases of missing Indigenous women along that highway. It goes from Prince George out to the coast. The symbol of the murdered and missing Indigenous women is a red dress hung in a tree. They do that for... there is a day, at least in Canada, for remembering that, and people hang red dresses in trees. Any other thoughts? Well, to finish off, I've got a video I want to show, and it doesn't show in this picture because this is from the architectural firm that built it. That this is a school built in 2003. Right next door to the Kamloops Indian Residential School by the nation. And one of the things that my friend Ron Ignace has been campaigning for years is something they call Indian control of Indian education. It's a direct response to the residential school thing that, well, you tried to figure out how to educate us, and you made a complete mess of it. We should go back to what we used to do, which is we taught our own children. And this school is, I think, goes through grade 7, and then there's a high school that's elsewhere that the kids go to. And the school is run by the nation. It follows the provincial education curriculum and then does more. And it brings elders into work with the children. It's called the Skellup School of Excellence, and Skellup, it means coyote in this language. And coyote is an important spiritual figure. He's a transformer and a trickster. He has both evil and mischievous side and a redemptive side, and it's one of those kinds of characters. And it is a good school. I've been in it many times, and it's a beautiful school. So what happened was a few years ago, I think it was about 2015 or 16, they decided to have a school-wide project on the residential school, and what they decided to do was to compose the song. So the staff and the students worked together in composing this song in honor of the children from that school. And I'm going to play it for you.
Oh. way. We live our lives so we're giving thanks.
That's all I have today. Do you have any further comments or discussion?
What is going to happen with the Kamloops School? It seems like it should be treated like other places in the world where things have happened.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I suppose there's some people who want to tear it down.
No, I should add some context that in the early part of that video, they were actually performing in the school, and the abandoned part of the school. Some of the part of the school was turned into some offices for the band offices. Although they have a separate office building, they needed more room, so they took some of it. But most of it is just vacant. They won't tear it down. In fact, what I didn't mention is that, you know, that brick building is not the only part of the school. The gymnasium is still standing, and it's been turned into a community center. It still is used as a gym, and it has a stage, and so they can use it as a theater. And it's where we used to do our graduation ceremonies for our program. And I don't know if you know, did you notice the kid who was wearing the coyote on his head? That's a chief's headdress. So he was playing the chief in that dance. And those were elders who were also school survivors who were teaching the dance. But when we used to go in that gymnasium to do their graduation things, that they eventually gave the chancellor of the university one of those coyote hats to wear while he's doing there, because he was the chief then, he was the dispenser of the degrees. Now, in fact, since we've used it, they've really modernized it, and it has it has some other recreational facilities in it and so forth, and now they've given it the name Moccasin Square Gardens. And it's really a center of their activity, and they are very cognizant that it was the gym of the old residential school. It's almost like every time they hold something there, it's like a victory dance. There's a reason why they insisted that the new school be right next door to it. There, you know, the symbolism is not lost on them.
Yeah.
Anything else? Thank you for coming. This is a discussion that, you know, people need to have in both these countries.